Welcome back to another episode of Eternal Possibilities. I'm super excited to have Dr. Bradley Few with us today, who's an academic general practitioner based in the Peninsula area in Melbourne, Victoria, who also is a lecturer within the Department of General Practice, Monash University. His areas of interest within general practice include, but not limited to, diving and aviation medicine, mental health and adolescent and young adult medicine, as well as medical education. Prior to joining the department as a lecturer, Brad was a Lieutenant Medical Officer for the Royal Australian Navy.
Let's firstly hear about how his career path began and how he transitioned from the Defence Force to where he's at now.
Yeah, so when I was in third year medical school, I was approached the military about taking up one of their military scholarships. As part of that process, you get paid a salary and rent allowance and that sort of stuff, and they pay for your textbooks, and so it's quite a good little deal that you get. In return, you have to give them an amount of service at the end of your contract. So I took the scholarship for 2.5 years, so halfway through fourth, fifth and sixth year of medical school, they paid for me during that. And then I did my intern and resident years at Monash Health. After that, I was then full-time medical officer for the Navy. So it was a interesting career. The first 6 months of my career in the Navy was officer training, doing, the yes sir, no sir, three bags full mm-hmm. sir, lots of push-ups, never been fitter, 5:30 starts, all the traditional military stuff, zooming around in boats, shooting rifles, blowing up stuff, completely non-medical. And then after that, you start in doing the medical work. I was posted into what they call fleet pool. So I was just basically a doctor that they would deploy whenever they needed a doctor. So the bulk of my military medical work was doing Operation Resolute, which is the Border Patrol refugee stuff. Providing humanitarian aid to the refugees as they come over by boat, so we'd intercept them. It'd be some pretty horrific circumstances that people would be coming from, some pretty unwell people, and then you'd have to kind of think on your toes of, they call it austere environments, where it's, difficult, the boats are rocking around, they're full of diesel fumes, people have got large lacerations, pregnancy, chronic illnesses, and you've got to try and provide medical care and patch them up as best as you can as they got transferred to various processing facilities. I won't go into the politics of what that was because I don't necessarily agree with what we were doing, and that's the joys of being in the military. You have no say in what, apart from casting your vote in elections, but you're at the whim of whatever the government tells you to do. So it doesn't matter what your personal political beliefs are, because I thought it was horrific that we're sending them to detention centres and islands, and because it's just not the way you treat refugees. But, at least I could try and provide a little bit of comfort, try and be a smiling face for them when they arrived and try to do my bit while I was doing that. So I did that for a while, and then I had a few other overseas deployments which were a bit more fun. I went over to Hawaii as we tested some missile systems and did some stuff with the US, and then did a deployment to China, which was a bit of a diplomatic one. We were celebrating the People's Liberation Navy's 60th anniversary, and got to play around with the Russians and all the other navies from around the world, which was kind of cool. So I did that owed them 3.5 years, having taken the scholarship for 2.5 years. Staying in the military is it's a tricky question for a lot of doctors. The longer you stay in the military, the less clinical you become. You become more in a medical administrator almost. So it was not really a path I was that interested in. And also there's a lot of time away. And by that stage, I found my partner, and the concept of spending 7 months and 12 months on deployment at sea was a bit of a tough ask. So it became pretty obvious I didn't really want to stay. But got some great training while I was in there. I got trained in diving and aviation medicine, which are transferable clinical skills into the civilian world, lots of mass incident casualty response stuff. With all the bushfires going on at the moment, it'd be nice to think that the government would incorporate primary care and general practice as part of their disaster response planning, but we're not included at all, which is something that the RACGP are working on at the moment. They've contacted Department of Health to try and do that. But it's an area that's evolving. So, yeah, definitely got a lot of great skills out of it. Had a great time, but, kind of glad to, kind of glad to be back into normal civilian life now. And so after I left, I continued in general practice, and I had a part-time civilian post while I was on base down at HMA Cerberus at one of the clinics, and I just kind of stayed on at the clinic that I had my part-time civilian post at and stayed there ever since, really. And then a couple of years after leaving the Navy, was looking for some education work. I kind of had to, that was part of my role in the military as well, was educating medics in the Navy, and I wanted to miss that after just doing primary care work for a couple of years. So I approached Monash about taking on a position, and that was 7 years ago now, I can't even remember. So I worked for the Department of General Practice for a number of years, and then now I've moved across to the Peninsula Clinical School. And now I've picked up another job working for Eastern Victoria GP Training, where I provide kind of educational visits to GP registrars and predominantly supporting the military registrars, actually. I've gone to the doctors that are based with the Navy, Army, Air Force, and give them some training advice and clinical visits and things as well.
So incorporating everything together.
Yeah.
I was curious to know, you said that you were approached to consider the military. Well, I guess, would you have any advice for any students or anyone in particular who might be interested in pursuing the military as a career?
Yeah. So, look, the bottom line for anyone thinking about the military is if you want to work full-time for the military, then general practice is your only option. Recruiting will probably tell you stuff like, oh, you could be an orthopedic surgeon, you could be a trauma surgeon, you can do whatever you like. The bottom line is they don't need that. They need reserve specialists. So the military have a load of reserve specialists. But for full-time doctors, they only need GPs. So if you as a student are thinking about taking up one of the scholarships and you're not interested in general practice, don't even look at it. The other thing I would say to you is the money is very enticing. They offer you this great kind of salary package and tell you that you'll be debt-free and all this sort of stuff, but you should never do anything for money in medicine, because you are signing on with the military and it is a... You have to be kind of that way inclined. They talk about recruiting people, talk about the psychology of people that join the military. So there are kind of three categories of people. You have people that will never serve. Military, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. I have no interest in doing it. You have to be crazy to join the military. So they'll never be able to be convinced to join. You have that can be convinced to join in the right circumstances. So I haven't really thought about the military, but it sounds like it might be interesting. That could be something I'll do. And then you have the born to serve types, family histories of military service, I've always been interested in military culture or military life. And that's certainly where I fall into. My grandfather was actually the Surgeon General for the Australian Navy. And he had World War II service and, there's kind of history of that, so for both medicine and military. And growing up, I was always kind of interested in military documentaries and things like that. So it was just a logical choice for me. So I think the people that tend to do the best in military are the people like like that have always been interested in it. I think if it's something that you're doing for a bit of fun or you're not sure about it, it's a big deal to take on. And I'd probably say think long and hard before going down that road. But an alternative to think about for people, and that's one thing that the bushfire crisis has kind of taught us, is that reserve service can be a really kind of rewarding and kind of less committing process to go through. So you can do your specialist training, whatever you want to be, and then sign on with whichever force as a reservist. You only have to give them 1 weekend a month, a couple of weeks a year. It's tax-free pay that you get. The reservists only get called up in crisis, which is when most people want to give their service and their time. So, it's usually not a tough ask. And I've worked with a number of reservists alongside in my full-time service, and they were know, there's some quite senior people, you know, Commodore Habersberger, who's one of the like chief cardiologists at the Alfred, she's like one, you know, very high up in Navy reserves. And there's a surprising number of very senior clinicians in hospitals that to do reserve work, and it's a great little social network as well. And it's a great way to, you know, have contacts, particularly if there's certain specialties you're interested in too. So.
It's definitely something to consider that I don't think most people are aware about.
Yeah.
How did you, I guess, get involved or get very interested in teaching and decide to take it a step further and try to go to Monash? Because that's a big step.
Yeah. So I think when it comes to teaching, I think probably some people are kind of more naturally interested in it than others. You know, when I was a medical student, actually, in my last few years, I actually had a job with the faculty when I was a medical student, because I was the last of the cohort that did the 6-year degree, so I was all changing to the 5-year degree, and I had a bit of some IT skills, so the faculty employed me to kind of help with generating some of the website content and stuff like that as well. And I actually ended up doing a bit of tutoring and things and really enjoyed it. And then that kind of got harnessed a little bit more in the military when that was a teaching role that was expected of me. So I think my just interest kind of grew from there. I think I've always kind of been my natural kind of consultation style as well in medicine. As a GP, I kind of view myself as a health educator, as a GP. You know, I think we have to educate our patients about their diseases and go off them in their management. So I think for a lot of GPs, being an educator is a logical step from that. So, yeah, it wasn't a hard kind of decision for me. I think I've been keeping it in the back of my mind for a long time about how to be an educator.
What would you say would be the most enjoyable part of being a GP?
So I think the longitudinal relationships that you establish with patients is probably the key thing. You know, a lot of my patients now, you know, I feel like I'm part of their lives. You know, I have patients now that I've done the shared antenatal care for, you know, done all the childhood immunizations for those children. They're now growing up and going to school and coming to see me. And then, you know, you get ones that you've been seeing for a while, and then the families, I look after 4 or 5 generations of the one family. So, you know, I'll have a family member that I'll have done the palliative care for and looked after the family during that time, and then the whole family come and see me afterwards, and then you really feel like you're part of people's lives. You know, the RACGP slogan, specialist in life, is controversial in the GP circles. A lot of GPs hate that term. They're like, I'm so much more than that. I quite like it. You know, I think if you just do the medicine, then that's what you miss out on as a GP. You know, I think being involved in patients' lives is what is the most rewarding part of it. And people are thankful for a good GP. You know, you hear a lot of people say, oh, I can't find a good GP, or, you know, GPs are rubbish, and you get a lot of negative press, and it's just because they haven't had the GP that they've bonded with that has become part of their lives. And because you interview the patients that have good GPs, and they all say, you know, they're the most important part of their care. You know, I've had patients that they've been in hospitals and then they're calling me up for advice from their hospital bed because, you know, oh, the doctor told me that. Do you think that's right? You know, and, you know, you're in a hospital. You're getting treated. But it's nice that they trust you and respect you so much that they, you know, they want you involved in all aspects, even when they're under specialist care in a hospital environment. Yeah, I think they're the best things.
Would you recommend more students to consider GP as a career? I think there's definitely a push for more GPs, particularly in rural areas.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think the government wants more GPs, and particularly they want more rural GPs. I think what we want is the right types of GPs. I think you have to be, it's horses for courses, as they say. You know, it takes a certain type of person to be a GP. You know, you have to be a good communicator. You have to be passionate about preventative health. You have to be wanting to be involved in people's lives. You have to be interested in a broad spectrum of medicine. You have to know a lot about everything. And so if you're not that way, geared, then general practice is not the career for you. If you want to be the master of IgA nephropathy, you know, and know every nuance there is to know about that, and, you know, then that's what the career choice you should be. You know, if you want to be regarded as, when people think of multifocal atrial tachycardia, they think of me, then you'd be a terrible GP. But if you're passionate about, you know, being part of patients' lives, part of a community as well, and particularly for rural, you know, GPs are a cornerstone in communities. And we're seeing that with the bushfire crisis too. You know, you hear about, I'm a member of a Facebook group called GPs Down Under, and, you know, just watching the GPs post over the last couple of weeks about their responses, you know, in their practices, they're setting up little emergency clinics, you know, bringing in drugs, speaking to specialists, you know, how can we provide care when we're cut off because the roads are down and we can't get evacuation. You see, and people turn to their GPs because they've got respiratory problems with smoke inhalation, and, you know, they've got the trauma of losing their houses, and you see the response that they have. Then I think that's, if that sort of role is what you would love, then, yeah, general practice is definitely the career for you.
Think about the different role that GPs can have,
yeah,
in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and even in metropolitan, you know, that you still, there's communities within metropolitan areas too. You know, just because you're working in an inner city area doesn't mean that you're not part of that community as well. So, and that's what tends to happen. You get a community of patients, you know, word of mouth gets around, you end up seeing patients recommend you from around the area. So it's nice being part of the community. Sometimes, you know, when you're down at the shops and, you know, they're walking down to go and buy your groceries, and it's like, oh, I've still got that sore arm, doc. And you're like, oh, make an appointment to see me about it. That'd be better rather than doing it in the fruit and veg aisle of Coles. But, it's a minor price to pay for being involved in people's lives.
I just want to ask you a few more questions about money and medicine. Mm-hmm. So I was really lucky to have you give us a talk last year. Mm-hmm. So as we know, managing finances is such a key life skill, but it's something that's not covered in the medical curriculum, and often we don't think about it until it hits us in the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really curious to know what made you decide to set up the talk and to give it every year in your own time. It's very generous of you to do that.
Well, I guess for me as a medical student, no one had ever talked about it. It's almost, I find it bizarre in our society, particularly within medicine, that it's almost taboo to talk about money. And I think it's because there's this kind of misconception that it's vulgar to talk about money. Like the bottom line is, in medicine, it doesn't matter what career you pick, you're never going to be short of a dollar. And the main thing is, I think that prompted me to talk about it is I've had friends that are specialists that are earning Uber dollars that are struggling to pay their bills and have debt coming out their eyeballs because they haven't managed their finances properly. And so I guess what I was hoping to instill in the cohort was that a bit of financial responsibility from early on can help set you up to avoid failure in later life, because we tend to, as doctors, to get focused on the medicine, which is rightly so where our priorities should be, and that can leave a lot of other aspects of our lives in a bit of chaos. And if you set your processes up early, in terms of your bank accounts, your savings plans, your super, your investment strategies, you think about that early, then you will find it easier, you know. The last thing you want to be thinking about when you're, you know, a registrar in cardiothoracics having just done your 38th hour on call is, oh my God, I'm not sure I've actually set up my loan repayments to come out properly, or, should I be investing this money, or, you know, what should I be doing with it? That you don't have time to think about that. So if you set it up now, then now's the time to do it. I've adopted a bit of, you know, a few strategies, you know, whether you read a bit of Warren Buffett or whether you read The Barefoot Investor. I think being interested in money helps you value it more and helps you treat it with the respect that it needs, or else it can become another source of stress. So,
do you have any like top three tips you would give junior doctors or medical students?
First one is if you're really not sure at all, is to get good financial advice. So find a financial advisor and sit down with them, you know, early on and set up a strategy from there. But so if you really just, you know, want to outsource it all together, you can do that if you find a financial advisor that you can trust and rely on. But I think the biggest three tips is set your super up properly. You know, it's always better to have more money going into super than you think you need, and to make sure that you're investing in the right style of super. So, you know, as young junior doctors, you're going to be in the workforce for 30, 40 years. You have the time to ride out highs and lows in the share market. So put it into growth and high growth, you know, profiles within your super, and make sure that your super is a low fee super fund. So I think that's number one. Number two is to think about a savings plan. And the reason for that is as your income increases, you get what they call lifestyle creep. Your expenses rise to meet your income. So you can go from, as a medical student, earning, you know, $0 a year, to as an intern earning, you know, $60,000, $70,000 or $80,000 a year, depending on overtime and all that sort of other stuff. And then as a consultant ophthalmologist, you can be earning, you know, $2 or $3 million a year. You can have a consultant ophthalmologist that has been earning $2 to $3 million a year for a couple of years that has no savings in the bank. And you can come across a junior doctor that's been doing locum HMO work for 10 years that can have $1 million in the bank. And the main difference between the two of them is that the one who saved has managed to not fall victim to lifestyle creep. They've had an investment strategy that they were going to have a budget of how much they're going to spend each month, and they would save the rest of it, investing it into shares or whatever you're going to do. Whereas the ophthalmologist has bought $500,000 boat and, you know, touring around the Mediterranean every year because they're stressed because they're working, you know, 7 days a week and they need a good holiday. You know, oh, I've got a couple of hundred thousand in the bank. Yeah, that'll pay for the Maldives and for all that sort of other stuff, which is lovely. But it's not necessarily setting you up for long-term success. So, making sure that you, Warren Buffett's famous quote is, spend what is left after saving, don't save what is left after spending. So I think that's a good attitude to set up from time to time. And the third final tip, I guess I would say, is to make sure that you have your insurances and contingencies in place. So you never know what's around the corner. One of the GPs throughout the bushfire crisis, who's based on Kangaroo Island, who posted his home being burnt down as part of the crisis, and the town, you know, he's not generating any income because his town is basically closed, the whole of Kangaroo Island, no one's coming in or off really, people have been evacuated, so his clinic's not making any income, his house is burnt down, you know, he's going to have huge expenses coming up, you know, so you want to make sure that you can be prepared for the unexpected. You should always have in the bank, in an easily accessible account, 3 months of your expenses. So you should be able to, if you cannot work for whatever reason, your income protection insurance only kicks in after about 10 to 12 weeks. So you need to be able to live off your savings for a period of time. So you have to make sure that you have that aside and that you're not, you know, spending it on the latest holiday to the Maldives and all that sort of stuff. And it's separate to your investment strategy as well. So, key ones are good financial advice, set up your super, save, be responsible.
That's something definitely to keep in mind. Because I feel like sometimes you work so much you don't have time to spend, or you're just like, oh, I think deal with it later, or it's not my area, I don't know anything about finances. It's really great to guess for everyone who's listening to, I guess, plan out.
Don't have to know a lot about, because I think for a lot of people, your savings plan is to, by default, to just put it into a savings account in the bank. And, you know, particularly at the moment with interest rates so low, it's almost a bad decision to do that because you're missing out on so much lost income. And everyone thinks that the share market's immensely complicated and difficult and risky, and it's not. You know, there's a reason why superannuation funds invest in the ASX 200, which is the top 200 companies in Australia, and it's because it's safe. Even if you go with a relatively conservative profile on your super, you will still find a chunk of that money will be in, you know, blue chip Australian shares. So if you invest in the ASX 100, you know, just buy some shares in Woolworths, in, you know, Combank, in, you know, Wes Farmers, whatever like that. And you're doing that for a 20 to 30 year, you know, investment plan, you would find it pretty hard to stuff it up. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. You know, I'm going to try and amass the whole entire of Woolworths. Don't try and do that. But if you have a good diversified portfolio, you know, occasionally disasters happen, you know, Ansett back in the 90s, whatever it was, when that collapsed, you know, there's a lot of shareholders that left high and dry. But if, you know, that's 2% of your portfolio, then you can wear it.
Mm-hmm. I'm just hoping to ask you as well, in terms of all your different roles, mm-hmm. So you work in a clinical setting, mm-hmm. You're also working as an academic, mm-hmm. And then you're also raising a family. How mm-hmm. do you manage all those different demands and keep on top of it all?
Yeah, so... that's the other thing with general practice is it does allow you so much flexibility with that, you know, and that's one of the most touted lines for recruitment into general practice, you know, lifestyle. Everyone talks about lifestyle. But it is true, you know, do have that flexibility. I have a three-year-old daughter and another baby on the way, and, you know, wanting to be around. I never wanted to be one of those parents that is absent from their children's lives. You know, I'm always home every night to have dinner with my family and put my daughter in the bath and give her read her stories and tuck her into bed. You know, that's an absolute priority for me. That's non-negotiable, you know, apart from the once or twice a year where I have a meeting or something where I've got to go to at night. 99% of the time I do that every single night. And general practice is great in that I can dictate my hours and kind of be flexible around that. And it's remunerated well enough that that I can sustain my lifestyle to do that. Yeah. And thankfully now, you know, with some careful investing and doing things over the years, you know, I reap a bit of income from you know, my investments that helps offset, you know, taking time off work as well. So when I do take time off work, I'm not necessarily, you know, not earning $0. It's still money being generated from investments in whatever you go along with. So that's helpful as well. So that's why I think it's important for junior doctors to start that early because, you know, I started my share portfolio when I was first paycheck from the Navy when I was a medical student. You know, that's when I bought my first set of shares. So you know, now going on into the future, you know, compounding interest and things like that. So you know, I've had ones that are risky shares that I bought along the way, kind of thinking, oh, I'll take a bit of a punt on that. You know, some, I think as a doctor you can be an expert on all medical shares. There's a company that was developing transdermal patches and I was like, oh, I'll buy a bit of that. That'd be awesome, and then they went bankrupt. but you take those little risks along the way, and it's a bit of fun. So,
in terms of, I guess, how do you think the system will change in the future in mm-hmm. the next couple of years?
Yep. So, yeah, we're kind of getting to a bit of a crunch point in medicine now, where particularly surgical and physician careers are almost becoming unobtainable. just in terms of the requirements, you know, it's the government could have seen this coming a long time ago. You know, as you open up more medical schools and have more places, the places for trainees into specialty training don't necessarily expand in proportion to that. We're seeing all these arbitrary lines in the sand drawn. You know, back when a lot of my friends started on their specialty careers, you know, a PhD was not really essential. Well, these days, PhDs for most specialty careers are essential. Where's the next step as more trainees come in the market? You need 2 PhDs before you can get onto a program. You know, so I think at some point the government is going to have to intervene and start, regulating places in training positions and having a bit more transparency around the processes and things as well. I think medicine is going to change. We're seeing increase in technology uptake, particularly radiology. One of my friends who's a radiologist, they're already using AI as part of their practice. Some of their chest x-ray reporting is being partially generated by computer and they're just checking it as they go along, and that's going to become more of a included in the system. So that's going to change the way we operate as doctors as well, as well as impacting careers and choices. The big thing that's going to happen in general practice, depending on governments, but at the moment I can tell that the Liberal government at the moment are trying to push general practice into a capitation-like model like the UK. So at the moment, we have a fee-for-service arrangement. The government scrapped a lot of our incentives and they're now putting this kind of quality improvement focus on, which is very NHS-like. So depending on what happens with the next federal election, we could see us heading to a more UK-style system of medicine. I fear for that because the UK haven't done it particularly well, which is why doctors are flooding out of there left, right and centre. But it's a very conservative government approach to medicine. What I'd like to see is a more progressive government adopting a more kind of Scandinavian-style health system where there's less inequity between rich and poor. We're already seeing that now, that your socioeconomic status has big impact on your health outcomes in Australia. It shouldn't do, but it does. So I'd like to see us heading towards a system like that. But the out-of-pocket costs and increasing expenses are really starting to hit home for patients in Australia. So it's a challenging kind of political environment because we've got an economy that's starting to, really flatten out. It's only our resources sector that's keeping that alive at the moment. So you've got governments struggling to balance the books to go to a proper funded kind of socialised healthcare system is very expensive and it's going to take some brave politicians to change it. And who knows what's going to happen with the economy because apparently Iran's just attacked the Americans in Iraq or something. So I think we're just getting to the turning point of doctors having a voice in the political environment. The College of GPs never used to have anything resembling advertising or political presence, but it's becoming more of a political organisation. So I think doctors are a really powerful force if we want to be and we want to mobilise. The problem is that it's hard, we're a hard group to coordinate, even on things like climate change where we all agree, AMA's come out with statements, RACGP, we're really not all that visible in the climate change space of trying to, there's groups like Doctors for the Environment and things, but it's not coordinated and there's not a real impact from that. So we're a hard group to coordinate because our focus is always on patients. That's where it should be. Patients come first, patient outcomes come first, but it doesn't mean that we can't have these secondary roles. And I think political campaigning and changing things that we're passionate about is important for us, particularly things like climate change. We have to be pushing that. And we're also in the position that we have exposure to the general public, so we can, talk about that. I talk about it a lot with my patients, about climate change and they say, the golden rule of medicine is don't talk politics with your patients and stuff like that. And I do try and avoid politics in general, but I think when there's political issues like climate change that are affecting health, and I think we have to be advocates in that space as well. So definitely make your voices heard. Yeah, junior doctors in particular as well. We're seeing that with culture changes, the horrendous bullying and terrible treatment of junior doctors that's happened in the past is gradually, should rapidly, but it is slowly changing. And the only people that could generate that change are the junior doctors talking out about it. So don't never be silent.
Yeah, it's good motivation to do something because sometimes you feel like I can't do anything on my own or it's too hard or not my business. But
Yeah, it's easy to get overwhelmed by a lot of different issues. But, you know, as a collective voice, we can be powerful, and on an individual voice as well. You know, I think we can change individual patients' minds about things. You know. Don't be, never feel powerless as a doctor. We're well-respected members of the community, you know. And if that's, there's a lot of doctors that are very politically minded, and there's loads of different opportunities in, for that. You know, Richard Di Natale was a doctor, you know, so just felt like he was better served, you know, looking at the country and trying to serve from a politician point of view. So it's funny how just by changing roles you can change your respect level in the community. Doctors, I think, are the second or third most trusted members of the community. Nurses are number one, I think. And politicians are the least trusted members of the community. So I wondered that. Richard Di Natale is now
in the
middle. He's a doctor, but he's also a politician. So you can pick loads of different ways to... there's doctors that are also using social media to kind of generate change as well. And in the media as well, doctors work in the media. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the things I did for a brief while I was Dr. Kiss, for Kiss FM. So occasionally, like I did it when Matt and Michelle were on the radio show, and they used to occasionally call me up when they had medical questions and stuff like that. Jason PJ have called me up a couple of times as well, who took off from Matt and Michelle. You know, so you can find all sort of weird spots to get involved with that are non-medical. Like Sally Coburn, who's she's Dr. Feelgood. So she had a prominent media profile for a while. So if you're interested in, you know, spreading the voice of medicine out there, you know, there's media opportunities as well.
How did you evolve with the radio?
It's funny. So just one day they were talking about a medical issue, and they were talking about something, a patient was manic or something. They were talking about someone with extreme euphoria or something, and all these people were calling up saying it's garbage and all this stuff. And I was like, no, no, I'm going to call up because it sounds like they're talking about someone who is manic. And I kind of had like this kind of miscommunication in the community going out. I have to kind of explain it. And then they obviously liked the way that I had spoken about it on the radio, because the producer, after I called up, said, oh, you know, that's really great. Thanks for clarifying that for us. You know, would you be happy to be like kind of our go-to doctor for it? And I was like, oh, that's all right. I don't mind, you know, call me up. So it wasn't a lot of calls. I think, you know, it's maybe like once every couple of months or something they'd call me up and they were talking about a medical issue. So it just kind of went on from there. But, yeah.
I should look that up on it.
you'll probably find, like, if you listen to some of the old podcasts, you might hear me a couple of times. But I haven't done it for a little while. And the last time they contacted me, they wanted me to come into studio because they were doing, Jason PJ were doing the 72-hour like live broadcasting, and they were going to have doctors check on them while they were doing it, and like, you know, I had patients booked in, so I was like, oh, I can't really cancel patients to come up and do that. So I think I kind of got a bit offside, not dropping my entire life to come and do some radio stuff.
That's pretty cool. Thank you so much. Anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I guess one of my big things at the moment is be serious about the climate. You know, there is a very, very real threat that we are under, and you know, as educated people, as you know, don't feel powerless. And I think it needs to be a priority for everyone on the planet right now that we all take steps that we can do to reduce our carbon footprint. You know, we don't need everyone to do everything perfectly. We just need everyone to do something better, and be vocal. You know, my wife always laughs because I'm an advocate of the sternly worded letter. So I love to write to politicians, and I love to kind of, you know, complain about stuff that needs to be changed. And people always think that, you know, it doesn't accomplish anything or it doesn't do anything. Every time I write to a politician or that I do stuff like that, you always get a response. It may not be the response you want, but at least it's flagging issues and, they're aware of what challenges are, because there are elected representatives and they need to know what they're representing. And at the moment, it seems like politicians are very out of step with a lot of the stuff that we're doing, particularly on climate change and things as well. So be vocal and be passionate and, take it personally. Do something.
So do you mind sharing a bit about what you write about to the politicians? Or that?
Oh, no, that's,
it's
curious
to know what you write about. There's lots of things.
So whether it be, well, Greg Hunt is actually happens to be the local member for my clinic. So we write to him, and he's actually come into our practice a couple of times and met with us, appears to be interested in what we have to say. But it's generally about the challenges in the health system, and because what you tend to find is that doctors tend to leave it to the AMA and to RACGP and things like that to tell, the health minister about the problems with our health system. But the problem is they are also large-scale organisations and they're not necessarily aware of what's happening, in the nuances of general practice. When I met with Greg Hunt, last year or the year before, I just mentioned, it was a pain in the ass having to call up for effects or, just certain medications, previous authorities. I can write a prescription for the higher dose medication without having to phone up for authority. But for the lower dose one, I have to call up for an authority. And that just makes no sense. And I just used that as an illustrating point with him. And he had no idea about that, because no one talks about those sort of things, those sort of little nuances with politicians. And how are they going to know to fix it if no one talks about it? So we're right to, and there's been a recent change about bulk billing incentives as well. So we, the whole practice actually wrote a letter to Greg Hunt about that, and he was having a meeting with us shortly about that. We're going to talk about the challenges to do with that. But, I've written to social services ministers about it on behalf of a number of my patients, patients rejected for disability support pensions because, Centrelink saying that they don't have a high enough level of impairment because a bureaucrat who has no medical training has determined their level of impairment, overruling my 15 years of experience as a GP. I just find that insulting. I write that to the ministers. I say that to them and advocate on behalf of patients for change like that. And writing to the Minister for Energy, writing for the Environment Minister, talking about those challenges, what I see on a daily basis, from climate change. I can tell you from personal experience, the last 3 years have been just horrendous for allergy and asthma sufferers. There is a noticeable difference in the amount of respiratory problems people are suffering with, and climate is a part of that. I write to the ministers to tell them that. Whether or not, it makes me feel better, I feel like the more of us that do that, the better. It's got to be a momentum. And I tell my patients that all the time, write to your minister, tell them this stuff.
It's definitely something, and think about that you can actually implement.
Yeah.
Anyone can do, actually. You don't have to be a doctor. Yeah.
No, they're elected to represent you all. So, they will, and I think they are mandated to respond to you. So if you put something in writing to them, they do have to respond. So
you can start something. Yeah. Everyone write it out for change.
Yeah, exactly. More people to do it, the better. So the other thing I find interesting when you meet with politicians behind the scenes, and I have friends that work in other industries, friends that work in the energy sector. One of my friends is he works on solar farm renewable projects and things as well. And they've all spoken to the energy minister. And when you speak to politicians behind the scenes, you realise they do actually want to make change. And a lot of them are just reasonable people trying to do things. But they're just hamstrung by bureaucracy, by public perception, and by being re-elected, So often as you flag things as more important issues to them, they do actually take it on board. And I've seen that when I've spoken to politicians. They do say that when constituents raise issues, they listen. they can't always do what we want them to do, but the more they understand about what they're doing, the more they can try and advocate within their party for that to change and for that to happen.
If you had to summarise your experience in one sentence or quote, what would that be?
That's a tricky one. So, in one quote.
Doesn't have to be a quote, just
Well, it depends if you're after, like, what my kind of personal philosophy is.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, is, you know, family, community, and family and community come first, I think, is important for me. If I've got, like, one little bits of advice for doctors as they're starting out and things. Be as open-minded as you possibly can to every single career. So I think there's the way that med school is geared now is it feels like you have to start first year med school going that I'm going to be a neurosurgeon, you know, because I need to get 5 PhDs before I'm even considered for the program and things like that. And that just gives you such tunnel vision. You know, you get to your middle age and then that's when you start to realise your life priorities have changed and families come along. And so I think keeping an open mind all the way along in your career is really important, and be flexible.